Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, April 15th, 2025, and our friend Colin Wilkerson is back with us. Welcome back, Colin.
Good to be with you, Nima, as usual.
Let's get started with the negotiations between Iran and the United States, which was so much, in my opinion, amazing to have again these negotiations going on. And how did you...
The Iranians are gluttons for punishment.
Larry, how do you find it right now? We talked about it before, but with the new sort of attitude on the part of the two parties, how do you find it?
Actually, I'm guardedly optimistic. That's probably not a good phrase, but especially not with Donald Trump. But Witkoff and his Omani go-between, who I understand it was the guy who owned the palace, or at least his envoy, which is a pretty high go-between, and the foreign minister from Iran, Arachi, at least were able to say that further negotiations are possible. And of course, Arachi raced off to Moscow to consult with his Russian colleagues and friends. And I assume Witkoff is probably rushing back to Israel to assume his other duties, or maybe to Moscow too, or Ukraine or wherever. This guy seems to be the Secretary of State for the United States. No congressional approval, no deeply steeped in diplomatic affairs, but he nonetheless seems to be the person Trump is going to turn to. This is not unheard of in American history. I think of Edward House, who worked with Woodrow Wilson. I don't think he was ever really corroborated by any of the official process. He just was a very influential person with regard to Wilson. So it's not totally out of the ordinary, but it is kind of strange that the regular cabinet apparatus is not being used. But Witkoff, as we've said several times, and as others have said too, seems to be a mild-mannered man who, despite his lack of historical and diplomatic and other credentials, and in this case, really difficult matters loom ahead. That, for example, Moniz, our Secretary of the Energy, and Salehi, I believe, for the Iranians, nuclear experts both, had to plow through for the JCPOA. So could be a torturous process for Witkoff unless there is a team waiting somewhere. And I understand that they've been talking with Rafael Grossi, who's the current head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, who has made some comments about the excruciatingly difficult process this is going to be if it does devolve into being mostly conversation about a verification regime and confirmation on both sides of acceptance of that regime. It's going to be terribly wrapped up in details, details that only a very few will know anything about. And the IAEA will probably be a very influential advisor to both sides.
You've mentioned Witkoff as the Secretary of State. And how about Marco Rubio? Where is him and what is his position in your opinion?
I can't find anything that Marco Rubio is doing of consequence except now and then announcing that he's done this or that to the State Department or to the Foreign Service. Like, for example, he recently announced, I think he's going to cut back on the number of consulates, embassies, and therefore people we have overseas, cutting back on the diplomatic instrument for all intents and purposes, which I think is a colossally stupid thing to do. But that's what I understand he's talking about. And he's talking about some other things in terms of downsizing diplomacy at a time when diplomacy is hardly even spoken, hardly even a word you hear in this administration. If you hear anything that even remotely resembles its diplomacy, you hear the commercial aspects of it, the deal-making aspects of it, the business aspects of it, whether it's Russia or Ukraine, Europe, whatever. There doesn't seem to be a real call for diplomacy, not real diplomacy. And people are saying things like, I heard this yesterday all day long, people sending me emails and everything else. How can you do diplomacy if you are shouting from the rooftops that you're going to bomb Iran back to the Stone Ages, just like you're doing the Houthis? One, when you aren't bombing the Houthis back to the Stone Age. In fact, they're standing up to you quite well, thank you very much. And two, this is a crazy thing to be doing, especially when you've just commissioned and begun negotiations in Oman. Well, I said to one person, look, Frederick the Great said diplomacy without the military is like an orchestra without instruments. He's right. The threats, the military aspect of it does have a place. Now, I admit, and I admitted to this gentleman in an email, that the braggadocio and the you know, the way Trump delivers his threats and the way Hegseth sycophantically backs up those threats is a little sickening and doesn't really do much for diplomacy. I'm sure the Iranians are sick and tired of it. But nonetheless, diplomacy should have an aspect of, you know, I think Churchill called it the veiled sword, or the, you know, the hammer underneath the velvet. But it seems the United States just wants to wield the hammer with no velvet at all. And that is a problem. That's a significant problem, especially with the nature and the character of Donald Trump.
You've mentioned Pete Hegseth, Larry. If we were before the negotiations happening between Iran and the United States, I could understand what Pete Hegseth was talking about. But here is after the negotiation, the first round of negotiation. Here is what he said.
Direct talks yesterday. They began in the past. It's been indirect talks with a mediator. But there's Steve Witkoff meeting with the foreign minister of Iran. What can he tell us?
Well, I can tell you that President Trump is dead serious on this issue. He's dead serious that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. He's said that for 20 years. He's been consistent. That is clear. He's dead serious that he wants it done at the negotiating table. He wants it done peacefully. Yeah. And that's why he's going straight to these talks. He set that deadline. These were productive talks yesterday. I don't want to get ahead of our skis. Steve Witkoff does a fantastic job, but it was a good step, and they're going to go at it again on Saturday. But he's also dead serious that if we can't figure this out at the negotiating table, then there are other options, to include my department, to ensure that Iran never has a nuclear bomb. We hope we never get there. We really do, Maria. But what we're doing with the Houthis and what we're doing in the region, we've shown a capability to go far, to go deep, and to go big. And again, we don't want to do that. But if we have to, we will, to prevent the nuclear bomb in Iran's hands.
Does he really need to talk this way, Larry?
No. Far, deep, and big. And the Houthis are extending two middle fingers to him because they haven't gone far, they haven't gone deep, and they haven't. No, well, they may have gone big. I don't know how much ordnance was expended. I hear it was quite a bit. But the Houthis are still there. And I dare say they will be there despite the United States' efforts to destroy them in Saudi Arabia's and the Emirates and a host of other people over time. They'll be there in another 500 years if the earth is still here. They're not going anywhere. So, yes, you're right. The first time, okay, before the talks in Oman started, now they've started, shut your mouth, Pete. Go away. Now it's time for diplomacy. We'll take your little sword out again, and we'll use it if we have to. And I'm not saying I want that, but I'm saying that that's the way you would do it. You don't keep pounding the whole time you're going into the negotiations. You've started the negotiations. Now shut up. It's time to be quiet. The Iranians know full well. What do you think? They're some kind of idiots that they can't understand the many times you've said this beforehand? And his words, if you go back and parse the earlier events and everything, the man hasn't got a very big vocabulary. It just smacks of sycophancy. Trump will tell him to shut up, I assume. Although I have to say, this is a president that doesn't seem to know when to shut up either.
Larry, in the case of Yemen, we've learned that it seems that the United States, together with Turkey, that was somehow surprising, UAE, and all of these countries are trying to manage the, as Iranians call them, Daesh or ISIS, and these forces in Yemen to fight Ansarullah. This is the same this same strategy that they have tried it before. Why in the world do they feel that this time going to be different?
It won't. You asked me why people keep, including the American Empire, keep trying the same strategy over and over again. And it's the same thing as beating your head against the wall and thinking that someday the wall will fall down and you won't lose your brains before it does. I mean, it's just stupid. I understand, I didn't mention this, but I understand Italy has offered its good offices also to these talks. And in fact, that there was a debate as to whether or not they would return to Oman for the second phase next Saturday or the second meeting or go to Italy. That's a good sign that there are other people that we would find acceptable probably, and the Iranians as well, offering good offices and offering a place to meet. Maybe that way, too, you could draw in some more nuclear expertise, because I continue to emphasize that if this is really what I think Trump wants, and I think it's a verification regime that he can trust, and the Iranians want a verification regime that he can trust so they can get sanctions relief. But that's all in the details. You know, the old expression about the devil's in the details. Well, we know from the JCPOA days, and this one's going to be probably much more rigorous, that the devil is, in fact, in the details here. You've got to have a program set up, a verification regime to go along with it, that's at least 95, 96% assurity. You can't get 100. You simply can't, because you can't be on the ground and destroy everything. That's the only way you get 100% assuredness. And then you don't destroy the software. The software is still there. I had a Sudanese tell me that when we were talking about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, he said, you know, Khartoum really has all the software. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we have all the plans and designs and everything because they smuggled them over here, the Iraqis. And that's probably true. I was also told the same thing about chemical weapons with Bashar al-Assad. Saddam Hussein had handed over many of his chemical weapons stocks to Bashar al-Assad for safekeeping. And I remember saying to the CIA agent who told me that, I bet he doesn't get them back because Assad would be stupid to give them back to him. But I have no doubt that there was probably some truth to that. So you can't ever destroy anything 100%. Like a chemical weapon or a biological weapon or nuclear weapon capability, because the software is always there in somebody's head. But to get really close, you need a pretty rigorous verification regime. And the Iranians will have to believe that they can accept that and that the parties carrying it out will not just be the U.S. And if there is U.S., it will be real nuclear scientists and not CIA operatives. And if it's someone else, they'll have to be able to trust them, and we'll have to be able to trust them. And the IAEA is a point where we ought to converge in that trust, but the empire has shown that it is very skeptical of the IAEA unless everyone involved is our agent. And we do put agents in the IAEA, and we do from time to time select their leader and make sure he's our man or our woman. So these are all details that are going to have to be worked out, and the trust is going to have to be there. At least a modicum of trust is going to have to be there. That can build over time. And that was one of the things that I particularly liked about the JCPOA. It was designed to build trust over time and to make it easier to do the verification and ultimately to maybe go beyond the 25-year moratorium that was set on it. Because both sides would be willing to do so, sanctions would have been lifted, Iranians would feel good about the deal, and no nuclear weapon would transpire, and we'd be feeling good about the deal and about the verification regime. That's what it's all about. And I just have a problem with Donald Trump having the patience for all that.
You think that he wants to get a deal as soon as possible? And
I think he wants to be able to claim it as soon as possible. Say within the year. And maybe that's possible if we do. And here's the other thing. I think Trita was right, Trita Parsi, the other day when he said, you got to talk about primary sanctions relief, not just secondary sanctions relief, but primary sanctions relief. And that should appeal to Trump. Getting American business back into Iran should appeal to Trump. For that matter, other than the Lindsey Grahams and the other, you know, Luddites in the Congress, it should appeal to the Congress too, or at least enough of them to make them more accepting of this deal, given that it's a Republican Congress, a Republican president, and the fact that business is going to be helped by relief of sanctions.
Larry, if we assume that after all, the United States and Iran can get along and can cut a deal on the issue of the nuclear program, what is the strategy for the Middle East? We know that Israel has nuclear bombs. We know that they're threatening Palestinians of nuking them. And on the other hand, we have the case of Yemen. They're not backing down. They're just continuing as long as Israel is attacking Gazans and just the blockade that is happening right now as we talk. What would they do? Do they have anything? Do you see any sort of sign that they want to do something about that?
Well, let me take the first part of your question there in a broad sense. First of all, Israel is a pariah with regard to nuclear weapons. Neither confirm nor deny. And the United States goes along with that in whatever diplomatic parlance of the day it assumes. But they're not an NPT member. They're not like Iran. They're not a safeguards and additional protocol adherer. They're not an NPT adherer. Iran has played the script exactly as it is supposed to be played. All the way through the JCPOA, we kept recognizing that with them. And that was a confidence builder and a trust builder. Israel is not that. Israel is a criminal state. Let's face it, within the non-proliferation treaty regime and international law and all the guises that were created around that over time, Israel is a criminal state. Now, it's a criminal state also because it's committing genocide right now. It's even got, two of its members that are supposed to be dragged before the court, or three, maybe Netanyahu, Smotrich, and Ben-Gavira, as I understand it, and a dead Hamas fighter. So Israel is a joke, a terrible, awful, sad joke when it comes to nuclear weapons. They should be stripped of them, and it should be the American empire that strips them of them. We gave them to them. Or they should be treated as the pariah they are. And no one should deal with them. No one should even talk with them diplomatically. No one should do business with them. And this genocide just reinforces that. So that's the nuclear situation. Who's the real problem in the Levant in terms of nuclear weapons? It ain't Iran. It's Israel. Now, to the other part of your question, I'd have to say this current conversation that I understand is taking place right now with a 45-day ceasefire and 10 hostages to be picked by Hamas to come back is probably a good deal and might just get this thing stopped. Because in that 45 days, I give a 60-40 chance of Netanyahu being tossed out on his fat butt and put in jail. Okay? You look at what's happening there right now. Look at how many, every type of Israeli military veteran and active duty group has come out with a denunciatory letter. 8,200 unit even came out with one. And he's busy calling these people traitors and wanting to kick them out of Israel. These are his core of his security state calling him out. Many of them for his lack of caring for the hostages, but others for the conduct of the war too. He's in trouble. He's in deep trouble. Firing of the Shin Bet head didn't help him at all either. And there are groups every day in the streets protesting either for the hostage problem or some of the other things like destroying the judiciary or the Haredim or not serving, still not serving, and so forth. So Israel has got significant problems. Got significant problems with Erdogan now also, apparently. I don't know how those talks went between Bibi and Erdogan, but I dare say they probably are not going to find it a very easy thing to do to come to some kind of agreement on how each is going to carve up Syria. In fact, I'm not even sure Erdogan has that kind of intent, but I'm certain Bibi does. He killed a couple more Syrians yesterday. He's busy going about whatever, bombing whatever the hell he wants to bomb in Syria. So I think Israel is in deep trouble. I've been saying that all along, but I think I'm right. It's building, it's building, and building. Certainly, Bibi Netanyahu is in deep trouble. So what does that mean if they go into this ceasefire? Well, I've heard that Hamas has disapproved it. Just before we went on, I heard that they said they didn't like it. I don't know if that's the truth or not. But if it does, let's just say for a moment it does go through. 45-day ceasefire. Israel never honors a ceasefire. But at least it will have to stop the major killing. It'll have to stop bombing hospitals, stop burying ambulances with dead people in it. And that will probably be a long enough time to get rid of Netanyahu. Then what happens? What happens then? What does Hamas do then? Once they've got him and hopefully people like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and their like gone. Who takes over? Is it a caretaker government? Probably. Do they have elections? How does it come about? And what does that mean for the war? Do the Houthis then back down like they did before? Not back down. They won't ever back down. But stop doing what they're doing in the Red Sea. That's what they did before. Because I saw too where the EU has voted $1.6 billion, I think, in rehabilitation and humanitarian aid. So we're getting to the point maybe where this is going to start to wind down. We're going to throw Netanyahu out. I hope they throw him in jail like they did Sharon. Sharon had cancer, I think, and died, so they gave him a break. But Bibi Netanyahu can stay in jail for the rest of his natural life, as far as I'm concerned. Be a good thing. So I don't know. I don't know where we're going, but I hope that there is some daylight opening up. If there isn't, I got to double down on my statement that Israel may take the United States with it in reputation and other forms of power, but Israel's going down. It's going down as a state. It will not be a state, and it will be irreparably so, I think, if this doesn't end very shortly, and it doesn't end more or less. I don't know how it can end positively because there's no positive aspect to it. But if it doesn't end quickly and abruptly even, and Netanyahu doesn't go, I mean, I don't think Israel will be around much longer if they don't.
Larry, what's going on between Iran and the United States, I think, could be part of a bigger picture of the Middle East. And because from the past and what we know from the past, the policy of the United States didn't benefit the United States.
And no, you're right. This could be a positive thing. I mean, it could be the ultimate, to put it in military terms, it could be the ultimate defeat of the empire. And I mean that. If Israel collapses, if Israel in some way is defeated, doesn't have to collapse, it's just defeated. It's sucking its hind toe for the next 10 years, trying to recover. Because it's economically devastated too. And I didn't even mention the 8200 unit even signed a letter. Many of the members of that unit signed a letter. The whole fabric of Israeli society is in tatters. It's falling apart. The economy is falling apart. The reserve structure is falling apart. The whole system in Israel is collapsing. We don't have enough money. I'm sure we'll try, but we don't have enough money in this country. Even Miriam Adelson and all the rest of these jerks don't have enough money to bail Israel out of the crisis it's put itself in. Willingly, straightforwardly, on its own, put itself in. With the United States, of course, backing it up 100% in the killing and the genocide. And as I've said before, that's been our purpose. That's been our purpose. I listened to, I lost his name for a second there. He was at the big Turkish conference. Jeffrey Sachs. I listened to him the other day. And I said, Jeffrey, it didn't start with Obama. He has some kind of fixation on the Obama administration. He wants to say that Obama did Timber Sycamore, the CIA operation, that Obama did this, Obama did that. Okay, I got my bones to pick with Obama too. We started it in the Bush administration. I was there, Jeffrey. I was there. We were fully intending to take down Saddam Hussein, march over into Syria if Bashar al-Assad didn't just collapse in agony when he saw Saddam Hussein fall so quickly. We were going to march over there and take him down. That was the plan. Then this insurgency developed. Why did Donald Rumsfeld tell everybody, don't talk about insurgency? I don't want to hear that word. He put that out in the Pentagon. I don't want to hear that word, because it was foiling his plans. We were going to go ahead and take Syria down too. And then when it didn't happen, when we got buried in the insurgency in Iraq, we started covert operations. I shouldn't even say we started them. We just fired them back up again. And we were doing everything that Timber Sycamore, Jeffrey's start point, implied. We were trying to get rid of Assad from 2003 forward. So don't blame it all on Obama. That's all I'm asking. Now, Obama had his crimes and ravages, but he wasn't the one who invented the problems in Syria with the U.S. We've been trying to do that all. We got it now. We've got it. We've got all these countries in chaos or gone in terms of the leaders we didn't like. And we'll never figure this out, Nima. People, leaders, do not necessarily make states what they are. You know, in the case of Assad, you could say, yeah, he did for a long time, along with his father. He made Syria pretty much what it was. But there are a lot of people conniving with him in Syria. Quite a few people, even outside the Alawites, there were people conniving with him. So you've got a state there now that's okay. We're okay with it. It's falling apart. Turkey's doing a little bit. Israel's doing a lot. Now we want Iran. Then the vendetta will be complete. Then we'll finish that strategy that we started with, the clean break strategy. We started it. The Bush administration started it. Whether the president knew he was starting or not is another matter. Dick Cheney knew he was starting it. Now it's complete. Now we have total chaos in Southwest Asia. Or Donald Trump makes a deal with Iran, puts a stopper in that chaos, and does what I think Donald Trump wants to do in the wake of that happening, withdraws from the Middle East. And goes back to, if he's smart, an offshore balancing strategy where we have naval forces, marine forces — naval means marine too, got to say that to Americans though — and maybe a few reception places like in Kuwait, and that's it. I would even withdraw our fleet headquarters in Bahrain. I'd put everything back in Florida. I'd have all the trappings of U.S. military power that's on the ground in the Levant now gone. And I think that's what Donald Trump wants. I don't know if he wants it yet, but he said indirect things about this enough to make me think he has intuited that it's not a good deal for the United States to be in the Middle East militarily. So we could — you're right, I think that was your implication — we could be starting something positive here, really positive. But the first thing we got to do is shut down Israel. Our attack dog. Our attack dog. And we're the only ones who can do it.
And do you see that sort of potential in the Trump administration?
I think I see an inkling of it. I think I understand a little bit about the way he's thinking. And I may be grossly surprised. He's got to get away from a lot of billionaire money and things like that. And he's got to escape a really pernicious influence on this country, which right now his minions and even he are aiding and abetting. The most serious thing he's aiding and abetting is the destruction of our Constitution with regard to freedom of speech. And he is overseeing that right now. I was really pleased to see Harvard tell him to go to hell about the money. I wish Colombia had. Colombia's not got quite the marvelous deep-pocketed endowment that Harvard does, but, you know, thank Larry Summers for that. Rape, pillage, and plunder in Moscow, transfer the billions to Harvard, become president of Harvard. Hey, Larry Summers was on to something. But that's what he's doing right now, and maybe if he wants to do that, if he's that pernicious, he's going to succeed, and then I'll change my mind and say, you may have settled things in the Middle East, but you sure screwed them up in the empire's home, because you've destroyed the Constitution, because that's what he's doing. And the tool he's using to do that, and this is what makes it so incredibly insidious, the tool he's using to do that is anti-Semitism. That's what he's using to destroy American universities. And I don't think he realizes what he's doing. If he does realize what he's doing and persists in it anyway, then he is truly an evil man, because that's worse than what is happening right now elsewhere, Ukraine, Gaza, and so forth, destroying our Constitution. I mean, that's suicide.
Larry, did you watch the interview of Tucker Carlson with the former Congressman Kurt Weldon?
No, I didn't.
And here is what he said in terms of, because I was wondering why Tucker Carlson has invited him to talk about Gaddafi, Bin Laden, and these guys, because these people like Tucker Carlson, they're so tired of these old policies in that region. They want some sort of change. Here is what he said, the congressman said, about Gaddafi.
They're back from Gaddafi offering to resign. The U.S. didn't want him to resign. They wanted to kill him.
Why?
Because Gaddafi, and I met him three times. I took Biden on my second trip to Libya, by the way. He went with me when I spoke to the whole country. At every meeting I had with Gaddafi, he wanted two things. He wanted to unite the African continent into a group of nations economically, like European standard, gold, like the European economy. He wanted to base it on the gold standard. And the U.S. and Europe didn't want that. And the other thing is they wanted control of his oil, and they wanted control of his sovereign wealth. So Gaddafi had to go. That's outrageous, and it's wrong.
Here's what he had to say about Gaddafi, Larry.
Well, Kurt Weldon was anything but a superb congressman, and I remember him well from days of being with Powell in two different capacities. But in this instance, much of what he said was pretty accurate. Much of what he said. I think when Hillary Clinton stood up and said, "We came, we saw, he died," that was a scripted remark that she had prepared much earlier. And I think it was a very, very visible sign of what Kurt Weldon said was our real strategy and purpose. And I think it was Britain's too. And I think Britain had a lot to do with talking us, just as they did in 1953 with Mohammed Mossadegh, into doing it. The old empire really, really finds it distasteful to not be the old empire anymore. Churchill wasn't the only one lusting for the return of the empire. So they live that through us. No one more than the House of Lords. They live their empire through us. And they will tell you in their cups that they do.
Larry, what's so amazing to me about Europe, and particularly about the United Kingdom, whenever I talk with Iranians and I talk with Russians, and you hear from the Iranian government and Russian government, they see the main issue in Europe with the government in the United Kingdom. What's that? What's the root of this sort of mindset in Iran and in Russia? They think that everything that is happening in terms of against the two countries is coming from the United Kingdom.
Well, I could just say perfidious Albion. That's the poetic term for it. That's what the French used to call the British. And that was when the British owned a quarter of France. I mean, they've had a tempestuous relationship for a long, long time. And so is Britain with the continent. I mean, Brexit in some ways was a manifestation of the old perfidious Albion, although I think there were a lot of other things that made Brexit come about, not least of which was probably, I'm told by good intelligence sources, that 1-2% of the vote was probably manipulated by Russia, who had every reason to cause dissension in Europe, and why not start with London? A very astute move on their part if they did do that. But Britain has always been, I mean, Britain was probably one of the most heinous empires in human history in many respects. If you look at the history of the British East India Company, talk about our corporate malfeasance, oligarchs, whatever, deep state. Wow. The British East India Company at some time in point was more powerful than the Queen or King it served. And very, very malicious. I mean, from slavery and the trafficking in slaves and people to British law canceling that practice only to be kept up by the companies, by the private companies and so forth. So despite people like Neil Ferguson, I think he says it Neil, when he came to the State Department, he told me his name was Neil, N-I-A-L-L, Neil Ferguson, trying to make excuses for the British Empire. It's very hard to do. It's very hard to do if you look at the black side of the British Empire. I'm not saying there wasn't some good. There was some good. As with all empires, there's a positive aspect and a negative one. But with the British, the negative seems to have lingered. It really seems to have lingered in their attempt to use the United States to fulfill their imperial dreams. I'll give you a case in point, though. I think I told this story to you one time before. I stumbled on it in the annals of the CIA at the George Washington National History National Archives. You actually had messages, one in particular, or several from this one particular guy coming back post-World War II from Beirut. I think it was a station chief Beirut at the time. And he was saying in his messages, very, very clarion call, listen, people, talking to Washington, his bosses in Washington, and ultimately to Harry Truman, listen, people, the enemy out here is not Russia. The enemy's Britain. They're trying to reestablish their damn empire. You know, this is the time of the creation of Israel and so forth. And it hadn't gone away, Nima. That's a long answer, but it hasn't gone away. Perfidious Albion is still perfidious.
Here is what Kurt Wellen said about bin Laden there.
I knew that we could have prevented it by the information that the Able Danger team established by General Hugh Shelton had gathered and tried to transfer three times and were blocked. So I said, I owe this to Ray Downey. I'm wearing his jacket today. I owe this to the firefighters in New York and around the country to get to the truth. If it's the last thing I do, and I owe it to all those soldiers that we're now sending overseas.
That's right.
So what I did, Tucker, I supported George Bush when he said we're going to send our troops over to Afghanistan. He made those heroic comments about we're going to get them. I took that as a patriotic American, said, yes, we're going to get them. But I was worried about what the Afghans might do as they did the Russian troops when they were in Afghanistan. So, Tucker, with Al Santoli, whom you know,
yep,
and two other members of Congress, I privately, without the knowledge of our government or the CIA, I went to Paris. We met with King Zahir Shah, the king of Afghanistan, who was living in exile with his family in Paris. We met with him to convince him to go back to Kabul to convene a Loya Jorga of all the tribes, to convince them to accept the American troops before they went in, so it wouldn't be like they did with Russia. King Zahir Shah agreed to that. I'll give you the photographs, Tucker. And I had two members of Congress and Al Santoli with me, decorated Vietnam veteran. Zahir Shah went back. I did all I could to protect our American troops, not the CIA, our troops. Then I find out my intel team, those 20 people that were feeding me raw data, give me data within months after 9/11 that bin Laden's been sighted in a town called Ladiz. I have no idea where Ladiz is. So I'd go up Pennsylvania Avenue to a bookstore and buy a map. I just gave you the map here today, Tucker. You can show it. And I found Ladiz. It's not in Afghanistan. It's not in Pakistan. It's in Iran, in an area called Balochistan. So I go to the next classified briefing for the full committee. Now I'm the vice chairman of the full committee. There are 60 members. I'm the acting chairman at this time. So I said to the CIA, I have information that Bin Laden's in Ladiz. This is their response to me. Mr. Chairman, we've heard similar reports. We can either confirm or deny them. I was in shock. I was in shock. We're sending kids to die in Afghanistan, and we can't confirm or deny whether or not Bin Laden's in Ladiz.
Well, Weldon doesn't understand George W. Bush and Richard Cheney. He certainly doesn't understand them. They really had no concern with Osama bin Laden. Their concern was with Iraq. And their concern was we were delaying our concern being satisfied with Iraq by going into Afghanistan. That certainly was Dick Cheney. It was not initially George W. Bush, but over time, Cheney molded him to that point of view that Iraq was a far more serious threat than Afghanistan. And that, oh, by the way, the CIA basically had finished our operations in Afghanistan. We also had a problem, and I know what Weldon is talking about because I was in the councils. We also had a problem with what he was suggesting because we were being told by the ISI in Pakistan and also by our contacts in Afghanistan who had been with Pashtuns and others who were opposing the Taliban, that this would not be accepted by the bulk of Afghanistan, that it would be a problem with them. That's when we started looking for a person who would be a neutral in that regard. That is to say, he would not create immediately problems with the different ethnic groups in Afghanistan. You've got to remember, too, that at that particular time, we were dealing very closely with Iran. James Dobbin, our ambassador in the region, was dealing very closely with Iran. And Iran was being extremely cooperative. They were helping us immeasurably at that time. People later would say, why did you screw that up? Why did you not take that warming relationship and make it into something? No, because Cheney didn't want to have anything to do with the great Satan, which is what he called Iran when they called us that, or Israel that. So it's a lot more convoluted than Weldon's making it, which is a problem I have with a lot of Congress people playing Secretary of State. They don't know the full picture. They don't know everything. They have people from the intelligence community running over and leaking to them. They have people from the NSC running over and leaking to them. And they put together this little composite picture, but they don't see the whole picture. Now, I'm not saying the NSC and the president see the whole picture either, but they do see it a whole hell of a lot better than the Congress. And the Congress ought to know that because the Congress designed the statute that made the NSC in the first place. So there's a lot more visibility from the National Security Council staff if it's run properly, and it's not being run properly by Trump right now, and that's a real problem, than there is in the Congress. So he had kernels of truth in what he said, but he doesn't know the full picture, nor do I, but I know a hell of a lot more about it than he does.
Larry Witkoff, before going and talking with Iranians, he went to Russia to talk with Vladimir Putin. Here is what he said about his meeting with Vladimir Putin.
He has a hell of a portfolio, you know it? He is the man.
Yeah, exactly.
Just a very good word there, Sean, emerging. I do. This is the third meeting I've had with him. This last meeting lasted close to 5 hours. We had two of his key advisors in the room at the time, Ushakov and Kirill Dmitriev. And it was a compelling meeting. This peace deal is about these so-called five territories, but there's so much more to it. There's security protocols. No NATO, NATO, Article 5. I mean, it's just, you know, a lot of detail attached to it. It's a complicated situation. from, you know, rooted in, you know, some real problematic things happening between the two countries. And I think we might be on the verge of something that would be very, very important for the world at large.
From what
I love to hear him say problematic. That is one of a diplomat's favorite terms. Go ahead.
The way that he's picturing the talks between the United States and Russia shows how deep they're negotiating, they're talking. That's why it's taking too much time, it seems. And how do you see it, the way that Witkoff is talking about it? Do you think that Russia is, he said about NATO. He said about NATO. They're talking about NATO. What is going on, in your opinion, in the mind of Russians that they want to put it on the table to negotiate with the United States?
Well, he's learning. He's learning as he goes along. And it's my appreciation of him, and I've never been in a room with him, but my appreciation of him, that he is a good learner. So he's listening. Number one rule for a diplomat, listen. Two is talk, and talk smartly and wisely, but one is listen. So we got a guy who's listening. He's not blustering like I think Hegseth would or even Rubio would. He's listening. And I don't know what he meant by that fifth territory unless he's talking about Crimea, because it's Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Luhansk. He must be talking about Crimea. That's all I can think of, unless they brought Odessa into it or something. I don't know. But he's beginning to listen to the Russian concerns. The one thing I didn't hear that I wish I'd heard, but maybe it's too early, is a new security architecture for Europe, because that should be the goal that everyone's shooting for, so that we don't just stop this war. We don't just stop the killing. We don't just end the belligerency between Washington and Moscow, the tool of which was Kyiv. We actually put in place a architecture that will ensure peace for another 100 years, or at least 50. And that's going to be the real ballgame. That's going to be the real difficult task, because otherwise what we will put in place, Nima, is just a recipe for a reopening of the war or another war somewhere else in the same region. Because you won't have satisfied the CSTO's security concerns, the Collective Security Treaty Organization's security concerns, and you won't have satisfied, ultimately, the EU's and NATO's, no matter whether the United States is still a member of NATO or not. And that's your ultimate goal, because that's been the problem all along. Once Bill Clinton put us on this expansion of NATO road, which was a disastrous decision, probably the worst strategic decision in the post-Cold War era made by the empire to expand NATO. Once he put us on that road, we were headed for what's happening right now. And Putin called us short on it. He called us up and he made us fess up. And now we've got to fix it. And the burden of fixing it is on us, not him.
Larry, do you understand what's going on with the new chancellor of Germany? What does he want?
I know that he's losing. He's losing voters even as he is, you know, getting into the job. The polls are showing they're going down. And, of course, the ones that are going up are not the ones anybody wants to go up. The right wingers, the real right wingers. I mean, Hungary's not the only place where Bibi might be welcome.
Yeah. And Larry, do you see Europe changing its attitude toward Ukraine? Or
I do. I do, as soon as the people get a real election going. Mm-hmm. And I know it's a problem. Like, Germany just doesn't have the process to do it. Their system is so broken. I'm not sure France does either. You know, France usually creates a new republic every time it runs into, what are they, on the fifth republic now or whatever. But France and Germany, being two pillars in Europe, do not really have a democratic process, nor does the EU writ large. It's big time this way. It's authoritarian to the max, but Germany and France do not have an electoral process that puts someone in their leadership, chancellor, president, prime minister, whatever roles, who has the support of the majority of the people. They don't. Now, every democracy has that problem from time to time. Alex de Tocqueville called it the tyranny of the minority rather than the tyranny of the majority. It's usually the majority that, you know, brings the tyranny about, whether it's over blacks or Muslims or whatever. But a tyranny of the minority can be just as deadly to you. And that's what they have. They have a tyranny of the CEO of BlackRock in Germany, and they have a tyranny of Macron in France. They need to get a process whereby they more often than not have a majority in their parliament or whatever it is that does their lawmaking, representing the people, not representing a segment of the people, whether it's far right wing, far left wing, in the middle or whatever. Generally speaking, if it's a functioning democracy, you're going to have a little bit of all. You're going to have fringes of the left, fringes of the right, and what I would call the great unwashed middle, which is most people. And you're going to have someone up here on top that represents all of those people, in some policies at least. But it's not true in Europe right now. But it will become true, I think, if their democracies are healthy and they stay together and they change accordingly. But they've got to change. France in particular needs a lot of work. It needs a lot of work. The French haven't got it right since Robespierre. They've tried and tried again to get it right. And, you know, I'm not saying America has it right. God forbid, look what we did. We're destroying our constitution and everything else. Maybe liberal democracy is just falling on its face. I don't know. There are a lot of people who would argue that right now. And that's why autocrats are having a comeback through democracy, you know?
Many of European leaders, we know that they see Donald Trump as a threat to them and to their establishment in Europe. But I see Donald Trump as an opportunity, Larry, for Europe. This is opportunity to be more independent, to be more, to decide.
To grow up.
Yeah. But they don't see. Do you think that this... they want to deal with Donald Trump, then somehow just let it, just the time, as time goes by, let's the time passes and he's going to be gone in 4 years and we're going to get back to the same sort of relationship with the United States. Do they really want to be independent? Do they really want to be a powerhouse? In my opinion, they're capable of being that. They're capable of growing again, but it doesn't seem that they want it.
Well, when you say they, in quotation marks, I think in this instance, you have to identify who they is. Are you talking about the current, I would even call it aristocratic, and it doesn't necessarily mean princely. It just means aristocratic leadership in Europe, including the EU, doesn't represent Europeans at all. Not in Denmark, not in Norway, not in Sweden, not in Finland, not in France, not in Germany, nowhere. Not in Spain, Portugal, nowhere. Not even in Hungary. Viktor Orban may think he represents most Hungarians. I don't think he does. If you're going to have a system of governments that are fundamentally democratic, fundamentally liberal in the good sense of that word, and you're going to build your own security architecture with that political process, that's one thing. It can be done. It can be done monetarily, financially. It can be done without destroying your social programs. It can be done so that your military instrument afterwards is fairly formidable. But if you're going to have this raucous debate amongst people like Macron, and I'm fearful to say like Merz, and like Orban for that matter, and like a host of other leaders we now have in Europe, then the who, the they you're talking about, is them, not the people. So put the people back in charge, trust democracy to work, and let it work. Now, it'd probably take a decade. But in that decade, as you're working towards those new governments in Europe who will accept the United States' reduced role in NATO, and what I mean by that is simply Rammstein is probably still there, maybe one or two other installations, but everything else is gone. There are no troops on European soil, none whatsoever. There is no headquarters in Brussels, unless that's where they choose to put their headquarters. And the United States nuclear umbrella still is over Europe. If you get to that point and you are building all that time the new architecture that accommodates the CSTO can go away as NATO will go away. And Russia will be an integral part of the security architecture of Europe. 10, 15 years down the road, you're in good shape. I don't know what the empire looks like. We're destroying ourselves domestically as fast as we're destroying anything overseas, especially with this anti-Semitism business. You know, Niemeyer, we used to have these conversations at Harvard, UCLA, Berkeley, Austin with UT, University of Texas, at William & Mary. We were called the Public Ivy League. So we dealt with Dartmouth and Harvard and Princeton. We used to have these conversations. The last remaining bastion of excellence in the United States of America is us. And this wasn't pride of place. We knew the university system, which attracted thousands upon thousands of students from all over the world, was the last bastion of our real power in the world, in the country. We're destroying that now. We're destroying it. And that's one thing I'll never forgive Donald Trump for, if he finishes it off. But I think we could get back to a situation where Europe is in good shape. Japan and Korea are going to have to do something similar, probably, maybe in conjunction with China. I don't know. I just had long conversations with some of my best friends in Tokyo and in Seoul. And they're really conflicted right now about where they're going because they see everything that's happening across the Atlantic and they fear they're next, you know, with this anti-alliance business or, you know, take care of yourself. We'll put our nuclear umbrella over you. But the South Koreans, both political parties, progressives and conservatives, are probably going to build a latent nuclear capability, reprocessing plants and then stop, you know, kind of like the Iranians. They'll be at 60 or 70% enhancement. Anyway, the world's changing. It's a multinodal world. It's a world that China will eventually dominate economically and financially, and its acolytes, the BRICS. You know, I said to someone the other day, do you know that in the Western Hemisphere is less than 1/6 of the world's population? The other 5/6 is not in the Western Hemisphere. Get out an atlas, add it up. Most of the people do not live where we live. That's going to change the world, is changing the world. We need to accommodate it. We need to learn to live with it. We need to learn to help it, to guide it, to get the international humanitarian law, the ICC, the UN and everything, whatever it is, reconfigured, reevaluated, redone, whatever. We need to get it working. And we need most of all to accommodate this massive shift of power, which is taking place from the West to the East, as it once took place from the East to the West. If we don't do that, then we'll never meet the climate crisis and we'll never handle the challenge of nuclear weapons. So, you know, it's an existential situation we're confronting. And we still have a lot of power. We still have a lot of smart people. We still have a lot of talent in our pool, still have a lot of good in our universities. It's not all destroyed yet, but we're fast committing harakiri. You know, we're fast committing suicide. We're killing ourselves.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Sorry, I'm so dismal.
Take care, Larry.
You're in our hemisphere, Nima.
Yeah. Take care.
Take care.
See you. Bye-bye.
See you. Friday, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Bye. Yeah. Bye-bye.